On this episode of Still Loading, does this thing even work? Hello all, it's Josh, and today we are talking about gimmicks, specifically gimmicks from video games, all the weird things that console manufacturers and game developers do to try to drive up sales, things from PlayStation Virtual Reality and Xbox Kinect, all the way down to the Power Glove and on the NES, or maybe things like DLC deals that game developers sell you, all the way down to difficulty spikes on the old rentals to drive up sales so that you couldn't rent the games instead on consoles like the NES. And today, to talk speak about this with me is my friend Jay.
It's me, Jay. Do you remember from that other time that I was here?
He's back. He's back.
With a vengeance.
Oh, don't you get him mad.
Oh.
So to start off, I'm just going to talk about, like, we each have kind of different topics, so we're just going to kind of go back and forth. I'm going to start out with things like the upcoming PlayStation Virtual Reality and PlayStation 4 Pro.
Mm-hmm.
So Sony is releasing PlayStation VR. Even, I'm just thinking about this now, PlayStation View. Have you seen commercials for this?
I might have. I'm not entirely sure.
From the commercials, it looks like their own version of a cable network. Their commercials are like, get rid, like, show, it's almost like a horror commercial of like people trying to get rid of their cable, and then it shows how great PlayStation View is.
Oh, okay. So it's not entirely, so it's relatively the same as like when 360 started when you could start viewing the internet, browsing the internet off of your console.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, it's kind of like the same
thing. It's like the next logical step, feel like.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But so PlayStation Virtual Reality, I don't really have to do much more than say what it is. Like,
yeah.
I mean, if you want to go into the specs, you can Google it, but essentially it's just virtual reality that's specific to the PlayStation. They try to compete with Oculus Rift. And then they're also promoting things like PlayStation Pro, which I believe promotes 4K resolution. So that way it'll drive up sales of like 4K TVs, which I feel like in a lot of game manufacturer or console manufacturers do this. They try to go that, like, especially Sony, like they did it with the PlayStation 3.
Yeah.
They're doing it with the PS4 by not having like an AV port. It's all HDMI.
Yeah.
They're always trying to push the next technological envelope.
I mean, it makes sense.
I mean, PS3 was Blu-ray before Blu-ray was big. Now they're pushing 4K TVs, because, I mean, let's be real, that's where it's going.
Yeah. I mean, it's just really, it's a matter of, this is just how technology works in our kind of society, where, you know, is what we're looking at in terms of virtual reality on the PS4 really going to work? Probably not.
It's probably hence the gimmick.
Is the 4K like really going to be important? No, probably not. But it's still important to invest in these ideas, if only because this is how technology first happens. When a technology first comes out, it's terrible and it's very expensive. And unless it actually gets some sort of investment in time, attention, and or money, or all of those things, then it's not going to become inexpensive and it's not going to become good.
It's very true.
You just have to keep, you know, it's definitely not something I'm interested in. It's definitely not something like I will let somebody else handle that part. But I'm sure you've known those people who will stand in line to get the first iPhone, the newest iPhone, because it's important to be one of the forerunners. It's important to, like, you know, I got here first.
Be an early adopter.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost a hipster mentality, but not like
sometimes,
an elitist
one
type of
thing. It's a hipster thing if they also gloat about it afterwards.
Well, and it's the same thing with, like, the 4K resolution thing that's coming out. Like, 4K, I honestly think, is the next wave of, like, movie watching for the home.
Yeah.
I mean, it went from, you know, VHS to DVD, and now we have Blu-ray, which is able, lets you watch movies in near movie like quality, like near theater like quality.
Yeah.
And in fact, because of Blu-ray, a lot of theaters are switching to digital projection because the Blu-ray quality is so good.
Does the movie theater industry even have the money to do those types of things anymore?
No idea.
Movie theaters are honestly, like, I hate to say it, but they're kind of a thing of the past.
Well, I mean, I still rather go to a theater. Like, I don't think that they're going to be a thing of the past. I mean, this isn't what we're talking about today, but, like, because people go to a movie theater for the experience of the theater. Like, you can, like, get a home theater if you really want, but no one has that kind of cash to build their own theater. And it's so much more fun to watch a movie in surround sound really loud with a big screen.
Yeah.
And with, I mean, I guess to kind of half-assed, like, tie it back, with the 4K resolution, we're getting there. Like, we're getting there to... So, maybe eventually, but still to have a home theater like that, it's really freaking expensive.
Well, it's just the fact of the matter that, like, there's only a few movies that I actually think it's... Like, it's important to see, like, a Marvel movie in a theater. It's not particularly important to watch the movies that are winning Oscars at the end of the year, because they're dramas. If Michael Keaton's face is on my computer screen versus on a theater screen, it doesn't really mean all that much to me, you know? So, and just straightly, less people are going, just because it's outrageously expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, though. In more recent years, I've gone to movies more than I have in the past. That's what's strange, though. But granted, there's a lot more movies out that I want to see now.
And also, I don't know, we're probably just more social creatures than we were a few years ago.
Which is weird, because everyone always tells us we're not, because we're always on our phones.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But
those people are stupid, though.
That was the first thing I wanted to talk about, was just, like, and that's where it's going, but... Mm-hmm. Whether it's good or bad, I'm not really here to, like, talk about that. Just kind of, like, comment on, like, what it is.
Yeah, it depends on what kind of scope you're using it in. In short scope, is this good? No, it's going to be terrible. In long scope, it's not necessarily whether it's good or bad. To me, it's more about the fact that it's important. It's an important thing to promote, just in terms of, like, this is just how stuff moves forward, man. This is just, you know, it's important to, like, keep adopting these things that are not necessarily all that great, but will get great later.
The next thing I wanted to talk about was the Xbox Kinect. Now,
probably the most prominent.
Yes,
in
I would say it's one of those. Like, don't get me wrong, I have no use for motion controls. Like, I'm not a big fan of it. However, and I like the technology went into making that, like, to do it is just astounding. Like, you've seen what developers can do with it. I've seen people like take the Kinect and then use it to be able to, like they hook it up to an actual projector, but you can, what they've done is that they've used the Kinect, I believe it, it's the Kinect, and they've used it so that way it projects, like, you know, like, you only see a certain part of the game on your screen.
Sure.
What they were able to do with the Kinect, and I forget exactly how they were doing it, they used the Kinect to, like, measure the room somehow, and it projects the parts that you don't see onto the room around you, so it's like you're peripherally looking at it, even though it's not on the screen, it's like being projected to your walls. And just the fact, like, I mean, early Kinect, like, you saw, like, it couldn't recognize a person compared to a couch.
Yeah.
And then later on, it actually was useful, where it can, like, recognize your hands and your face and stuff like that, to the point now where it's borderline creepy, because who knows who's listening?
I'm not even entirely sure if borderline is the most appropriate word. I think it's just straight-up creepy, just in general. The best use of motion capture, I guess it would, I mean, just like with the Wiimote, just like with like the standard Wii, even though
PlayStation Move is similar to that, it's essentially like a cheap, well, not a cheap, but a different version of a Wiimote.
Yeah, I just think it wasn't necessarily the technology that was different, but I just feel like the games that I saw most heavily promoted for the Kinect just weren't particularly interesting. It was just like a dance kind of thing, and it just seems so two-dimensional to me. It just seems like, well, yeah, of course you're going to do that. But with the motion capture being only relegated to a particular controller, with the way it did, like, Twilight Princess, where you had to, like, shake it for, you know, perhaps people found that to be irritating, but I thought it was kind of, like, a neat idea.
Yeah.
And, like, some of, like, the Wii Sports, and just, like, the generalized idea.
Well, and they even improved on that. Like you said, if you don't have early adopters, then you can't innovate. You can't, like, fix the issues of what happened in the first model. They took the issues with Twilight Princess, and then they made it into Skyward Sword, which a lot of people say, like, yeah, it's still not not the greatest Zelda. That's a very, like, not a lot of people like that Zelda. It's like, yeah. very hot or cold.
Uh-huh.
A lot of my roommates love it. A lot of people I listen to on other podcasts despise it.
Oh, yeah. There are some people who despise
it. But the thing is, though, it had, at least the motion controls worked. They were functional.
Yeah.
They weren't the most fun. Like, they were fun. I have not personally played it, but from what I've been told, they're fun sometimes, but they don't quite work at the same time. So, like, but they're functional.
Mm-hmm.
The Twilight Princess ones weren't very functional from what I heard.
Yeah. It was very bare bones.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the idea of it being exciting. Like, just having that element to it, I guess, is something that Shigeru thought was, like, particularly important.
Well, a lot of this stuff, too, like, he, like, at least with Miyamoto, he always tries to do, like, he always tries to innovate with new ways to play. So that was his, like, motion controls for the Wii was just the next innovation of that. Like, he, like, if you look at a lot of the Nintendo games, they're always trying to, especially ones designed by him, he tries to find new ways to for people to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's always trying to find that next thing that's just a little bit different than the competition. Because while I love PlayStation, I'm a Sony fanboy, admittedly.
Right.
They don't really change that much.
No, what you're going to get.
You know what you're going to get. And that's probably why I like it, because the games can innovate, but the console hardware just ups, like, their stats.
Their abilities,
abilities, exactly. Nintendo, for better or for worse, they're constantly trying to change their hardware to find new ways to make a game interesting or fun. And it started out with the DS. Like, the DS. With their hand, with the touchscreen and mm-hmm. all the cool things. I mean,
stylus, yeah.
I mean, they had some bad stuff and, like, some stupid...
Well, that's going to happen,
Like, I guess the microphone on the DS.
Yeah.
There's so many times when I'm on an airplane, it's like, you got to scream to this. I'm like, I'm not going to scream to this fucking thing. Like, I'm on an airplane.
Get out of my face about this.
So I'll just take my finger and I'll rub it over the mic real fast to see if I can do that. And then, of course, it trolls me and says, oh, you didn't scream, actually, did you? Because all you had to really do was just snap your fingers. You probably looked like an idiot. Like, it happened to me.
Oh, yeah. I don't doubt it. But also, I would also argue that chances are the reason why we are bigger fans of Sony versus Nintendo's idea, even though we objectively appreciate what Nintendo is doing, it's not necessarily what we're doing, it's just because that's not really their clientele. We're definitely the kinds of people, we take, I don't know, I would argue that we take games a little bit more seriously. My sister is significantly more of a Nintendo type of person. Somebody who just plays games to have fun rather than, I don't know.
Well, like, we still play as games to have fun, but, like, our version of fun is different. Like, we like games
that... I would argue that I would want... what I'm looking for is significantly more experiential. Like, I want something from the game in terms of its gameplay, not necessarily its creativity.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, and, like we said, like, Nintendo innovates on the console itself, not necessarily... Because they innovate on the console, it forces game design to go in a way we wouldn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
For better or for worse, like, some of it's fantastic. Like, when you look at the Wii, Wii Sports is amazing. I still have fun playing Wii Sports. It works really well.
Yeah.
But when you have games that, like... But when they make every single game, like... I think my biggest problem with Nintendo's gimmicks, quote-unquote,
mm-hmm.
is that they... Now, the old ways, I liked it more because it was a gimmick, but they didn't force everyone to go along with it. With how they do it now... It's forced. So, like, when you play any game, like, for example, I tried out Call of Duty on the DS one time.
Yeah, how did it go?
Well, the controls suck.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm not surprised.
You expected that.
But it's gimmicky because, like, and they made every DS game do this, where somehow you had to use the stylus in some way. You couldn't just play a game.
Mm.
Like, Mario, they let you do that, but not a lot of other games.
Mm.
In Call of Duty, you had there was a section where you could, like, dismantle landmines, and you had there was four screws, and you put your stylus on the screw, and you spin it around on the touchscreen to, like,
tedious.
Take the screws out. I'm like, I get it, you're trying to be immersive, and for the first, like, two times, I'm like, this is really cool.
Yeah.
But when you're making me dismantle, like, tens and 20s and, like, 20, 30,
dozens,
40 dozens of mines, it's a little bit, like you said,
it's
tedious.
Yeah. It's not particularly interesting.
No.
No. It's... I don't know. Again, it's just like, I think the particular clientele that they're looking for is definitely not us. It's the people who are slightly older than us, starting to get back into gaming, or maybe for the first time,
mm-hmm.
and kids. I mean, just to at least maintain a certain amount of active part of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there's a handful of times where I feel like a console or a particular game is trying to do something that's trying to buck the stereotype of people who play video games just sit in their basements and they're incredibly unhealthy and stuff like that. Even though their attempts to making it seem significantly, this is excluding Pokemon Go, which does this beautifully. which really makes active working to it is just great. It really, I think one of the biggest regrets in my life is having a phone that can't play Pokemon Go.
It's
probably the most depressed I've been with with not having the ability to play Pokemon Go.
Well, you can always get a new phone eventually. I mean, it's still like really popular.
I mean, I'll probably just
fresh.
Take yours by the time we finish the podcast.
Oh, okay, good.
You know, I'm not going to tell you about that.
I wouldn't expect you to.
No, you got to stay on guard.
All right, and so on to the PS2. Only thing that I really had, there's two things I found particularly interesting, and I'll put a little disclaimer, and I'll give links to all these videos I got a lot of this information from. There's a YouTube channel called Did You Know Gaming, and they are fantastic for, like, obscure video game facts. So, for example, the first thing I want to talk about in terms of, like, gimmicks or peripherals that they used, that Sony used to try to sell the console, the iToy.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever play with the iToy at all?
No. No, it's not my type of thing.
My friend down the street growing up, he had an iToy, and it was actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
But it was very, it worked surprisingly well. Like, essentially, it was a Kinect that was as good as a Kinect, but back on the PS2. Like, there was a snowboarding game, and, like, when you jumped, the character jumped, and it, like, you didn't have to awkwardly lunge forward to make it go. You just had to duck down,
because
like a snowboarder would. Mm-hmm. The other game that he had for it was actually DDR.
Okay.
Now, I guess to clarify, I'm not counting the Dance Dance Revolution pads on this, because Sony did not make those to sell the PS2. It was just, I guess everything helps, but that was not something they were pushing. Like, Sony specifically made the iToy in the hopes to entice more people to come in to buy a PS2. But it was weird for DDR, because you would plug the iToy in along with the dance pad, and while you're doing the step moves, you have to wave your hands to wipe away fog off the screen, and the iToy would do. It was kind of cool.
Weird, but okay.
It was kind of cool, though. Yeah. And the other thing I want to talk about, I don't know if you know about this, you could actually install Linux on a PS2.
Why would you want that?
Well, you could actually turn your PS2 into like a PC, essentially. Like, you could buy, it came in like a kit. You could get a hard drive, which had a network drive as well in the back. You plug that into the expansion bay in the back, and then had a Linux install, Linux install disk. And it came with a mouse and keyboard as well. So you could plug the mouse and keyboard into the USB ports on the front of the PS2, install Linux onto the hard drive, and essentially you have a functioning PC that also lets you play PS2 games.
Yeah, I suppose. I feel like for the most part, people are just going to be like, well, I have, you know, my PC, and then I have my PS2. Some people find, I guess I'm kind of a rarity in the sense that I've always found, I want my PC for PC things, and then I want consoles for the gaming portion of it. I've never been much of a gamer on the PC, which is arguably significantly rare compared to, especially now.
With Steam and everything.
Yeah, oh yeah, with Steam and
PC gaming's exploded.
Yeah,
now.
Basically the only game that I really played was like Guild Wars. You ever played Guild Wars?
I played Guild Wars.
Yeah, it was fun. But
I couldn't get into it because it's focused so much on multiplayer. Like, obviously it's an MMO, but like, because your only multiplayer part is in the towns and all the outside town stuff is instanced.
Yeah.
I never had anyone to play with, so
that's always been the most frustrating thing to me. Every single time, my friends would get so obsessed with a game, and they wouldn't stop talking about it. Cut to 2 months later, I finally get the game, and they've already moved on to the next thing, and I'm just sitting there like a lump, trying to play, like, StarCraft was like that.
I play StarCraft with you. I would play the shit out of StarCraft with you.
Well, now I can't play StarCraft, because I've seen pro Korean players play it, and so when I try to play it, I just feel like, well, this guy sucks. It's like, well, yeah, I do suck at it. It's really difficult to, like, meet expectations
when
you watch pro players. Oh my god, it's ridiculous.
But, it's just crazy. Well, it's funny, because, like, the PS2 you could turn into a PC, essentially, with a Linux, with the Linux install kit. But what it's funny is, like, consoles have kind of gone towards PCs more and more. Now they now all have internal like memory storage. They all can now go online. You can browse the internet. The only thing it doesn't really have is a built, like, it doesn't come with a keyboard and mouse, which you can still buy separately if you really want to.
A lot of times
to.
You can still do that.
Essentially, that's what it is, but instead of like having an operating system you're used to, it's an it's the game console's operating system.
Speaking of the a keyboard and mouse, and speaking of gimmicks, just in terms of like a really hilarious way of like getting like a new game out of something, you know the game House of the Dead?
Typing the of shooter. The Dead?
Exactly. Yeah. You know exactly where I was going. Yeah. That game is hilarious. You always have like, when it doesn't matter how big the game room is, at any con I've gone to, whether it's like the smallest con I've gone to or the biggest one that, you know, has an entire, you know, center dedicated to it, there's always one guy who has brought a setup for Typing of the Dead, and he can't wait to show you how hilarious this game is. It's so fantastic.
It is a funny game. I've watched playthroughs of it, and like the words they make you type are just insane.
Oh no, yeah, they're absurd.
Phrases and sentences. It's kind of, I mean, I didn't actually get a lot of information on gimmicks for the Dreamcast, but I forgot about that. Like, you, and that's one thing for my Dreamcast I've honestly really wanted, because I've seen Typing of the Dead, and I'm like, this is awesome. But I don't have the keyboard, and I have not been able to find a keyboard. And I mean, I guess I could go to eBay and find one, but I don't have it set up right now, and I don't really have the space for it.
No,
so
like, I don't think it's particularly important.
No.
When I think of like gimmicks that could potentially, like, you could call on Dreamcast, would be like, remember how it used to have like the memory card that you put in, but then it would also have the screen on the front
of it? Oh my god, how did I not
think
of that?
Yeah, and it would just like, I'm trying to remember, did it have like audio cues? Like, the memory card would say or do something when you played
it in a
particular
game?
It did
have some audio stuff.
Am I just making that up? Okay.
No, no, I remember because I was playing, it was either Sonic Adventure or Jet Grind Radio on the Dreamcast.
One of those two is one of the greatest games ever made.
The
other one is a total waste of time, I think.
Well, I'm guessing you're saying Jet Grind Radio is the great one.
Oh my god, is it amazing.
Okay, just making
it's
sure.
Can you imagine how different our friendship would be if you found out that I thought Sonic Adventure was like one of the greatest games of all time?
Well, I wouldn't think much different because I have a lot of friends who really like that game. Like,
really?
A lot. Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. People have their
I can't...
I tried. I mean, it's... For a 3D Sonic game, it's probably the best one.
Dude, Sonic 3D Blast!
Sonic Adventure Battle 2 or whatever. I've heard that's good, too. Yeah. I have 3D Blast. I've not played it yet.
Oh my god, is it great? It's not actually great, but it's really great.
I was surprised you got so...
that was one of the games where it's like, even when I was a kid, I was like, oh man, I know this is terrible, but I love it. I love it so much. This was still back when, like, Sonic games were good. Like, 1, 2, and 3... I mean, I guess there might be people who disagree with me. I don't think there's a lot, though. But, like, modern Sonic games have been pretty awful. Like,
the most recent modern, quote-unquote, and I use modern loosely because it's probably 10 years old now, the Sonic Rush series on the DS, which those were really fun. I'm playing through the first one for the first time on my DS, and I'm really liking it so far. We talked about the PS2. I did some research to find stuff for the GameCube. The only thing I didn't find anything too interesting. The only thing I can think of was that they did have the Game Boy Advance deck that you could plug into the bottom of the GameCube and play Game Boy Advance games. And they had some really cool like sync up things where like you could things from like if you had the Game Boy Advance counterpart of the GameCube game, like a lot like the Metroid Prime and Metroid Zero Mission. I forget which one specifically.
I'm not sure.
Like you could like by having that plugged into the game to the Game Boy Advance deck that plugged into the GameCube and having Metroid Prime and you could like do something. I forget it unlocked something in the game to play like an original version of Metroid, I think. I forget. It was something like
that.
Well, I could be talking out of my ass because I didn't, like I said, I didn't research that part because it was something I just thought of now.
Yeah.
But I always thought that was cool. Like, and they had a lot of like, I think the Four Swords Adventures, you could, that was big in on the Game Boy Advance slot. Also, Wind Waker, the Tingle Tuner. That bizarre thing.
Yeah.
Wind Waker
was a great game.
It
was really good.
It's one
of
my favorites.
It's a very off-quality game.
Well, and I just liked it so much because it was so... It kind of brought back old Zelda and the idea that it's much more exploratory. Like, it was still linear where, like, you have to go here, here, and here. But to get there, you had to... It would take, like, a good 15, 20 minutes of just sailing and exploring the world.
Yeah.
I loved that.
Yeah. The animation was great, too.
It was one of those games where it truly, like, it was panned when it came out. But as people, like, got older, like, actually, this game's fantastic. Why did we hate it so much? It was just the art style.
I would argue that you could kind of include cel shading as, like, a... like that type of animation as a gimmick, so to speak, because some games would promote that as like a really like this is a really like a really cool thing. And there were a handful of games where I mean, yeah, it was like that, but they weren't good games, and so really cel shading kind of got related to games where they didn't really put a lot of thought and quality into the story or the gameplay.
Well, what's funny is with cel shading. Maybe you can talk about this being a gimmick from like a game developer standpoint. It ages them. I would argue cel shaded 3D games age better than any other realistic quote unquote games. Because like I loved Medal of Honor Frontline when it came out. I thought it was the best looking game ever. It still is one of my favorite of all time. Mm-hmm. But when I go back and play it. The graphics look horrible because you're so used to the new stuff now. But when you go back and play Sly Cooper, it still looks good because, like, art direction is key. Like, more than anything, it can still be a realistic-looking game, but as long as the art direction is good. Like, for example, Half-Life 2. Yeah. Graphics look very dated, mm-hmm. but they still look good because there's good art direction. World of Warcraft, granted they've done a lot of upgrades on the graphic, like a lot of upgrades, but for the most part they're just taking the same engine and modifying it. It still looks good because they have good art direction.
Yeah. I would argue with like kind of like cel shading where it's like if you take that versus a game that just uses the console to its outer limits and then cut to 10 years later, a game that just tries to look as good as possible and take the console to its outer limits just looks outdated. Meanwhile, another game that just kind of like understands what it is and tries to go a different way can just turn into something retro, and I think that just looks a lot better.
Well, in retro games, but then at the same time,
At the same time, now that I'm thinking about it, you remember Shadow of the Colossus from PS2? That pretty much took the PS2 to its furthest possible.
I still think that looks good,
and this is what I'm talking about. Where I think I came up with a game that just kind of like destroyed the point that I was trying to make before.
Devil's advocated yourself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, but Shadow of the Colossus might be one of my favorite games of all time.
It's I played it originally on the PS2, and like after the HD remake had all came out because I didn't own it yet. And I was blown away by it. Yeah. Sorry, finish what you were saying.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say. It's like it's amazing, and it shows that it's important to. There are always exceptions to the rule. Like, there's always certain gimmicks that stay kind of tried and true, and maybe don't classify as gimmicks. But does a gimmick necessarily have to be considered bad?
No, I don't. Not that at all. Like. Yeah. A lot of the stuff I'm talking about, like the iToy, I would argue wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't successful, but it wasn't a bad thing. The Kinect wasn't a bad thing. It was moderately successful, but it's still not like a bad thing. It's not my cup of tea, but I'm all for it existing. I'm glad it does exist, despite some of the bad games that came out because of it.
Bad games are always going to come out for, you know, whether they had the technology for it or not.
And then you go back even further, like, we just talked about, like, you know, the Dreamcast and the GameCube and stuff like that. You go back to the N64, you had, like, Hey You Pikachu, which...
Hey You Pikachu,
now,
man.
Granted, that was more of a game based versus a console, but that was a microphone. It was a microphone. Like, it was, that was like one of the first microphones you could plug into a console. I'm sure. Yeah. Well, sorry. The Famicom, the Japanese one, had a microphone for it, but in America, we didn't. Like, not that I can think of. Like, there wasn't a whole lot to use it for, except for that. And I mean, granted, it controlled like shit, but like,
oh my god, it controlled hilariously.
Did you actually play it?
Oh yeah. Just as long as you included a handful of keywords in particular places. It didn't matter what the rest of what you were saying was, just as long as, like, you ended it with Pikachu, then you would do the thing that, fuck you, Pikachu. And, you know, you see the Pikachu just like, hey!
I'm a good Pokemon!
Yeah, Pikachu would have an apple, and you're just like, I want you to kill yourself with that apple. I ended it with apple. He knows to eat the apple. There you go.
That's amazing.
That's all you gotta do.
That's amazing.
Hey, you Pikachu was terrible. it was terrible, but man, was it great. It was terribly great.
That's one of the things I have to add to my collection list.
I'm willing to bet that you can get Hey You Pikachu along with its microphone for a dime.
I doubt that. Just because it's bad doesn't mean it's not worth anything.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Yeah.
Look at games like Stadium Events for the NES.
Yeah.
Worth tens of thousands of dollars.
Ooh, N64, Pokemon pseudo gimmick type thing. You remember Pokemon Stadium?
Yes.
You were able to take your collection from Pokemon Red and Blue and
with the game pack on the back. I have that thing.
Yeah.
That thing's amazing. Yeah. I played Pokemon Red and Blue.
Good idea.
It was great because granted, now that it blew my mind when I was a kid, but I didn't know that the Super Game Boy existed for that Super Nintendo.
Sure.
Because I didn't have a Super Nintendo growing up. But one thing I wish that came out for the N64 and this. In America was the 64DD or the disk drive.
I'm not sure if I know what you're talking about.
So they released a disk drive in Japan only for the Nintendo 64. They announced it back when the N64 came out, but it was released much, much later, like 2 years after it was like the N64 came out. So by that point, N64 had already started running its course, because I think that by then it was like 98 and we're already getting close to the Dreamcast and the PS2.
Yeah.
And it didn't do too well. What you do is you need the N64 modem, which was literally like, so the DD plugged in underneath the console, and the modem would literally, it was a cartridge, an N64 cartridge that you plug in, and it just had a phone jack in the back of it, and that's how you plugged it into the internet. And so you could actually play games online, you could play demos, surf the internet, email, and a couple other uses, online service was called RANNet, and RAND.net.
Classic internet stuff, man.
You could even play against other people on some games, which that's crazy to think about on the
N64. N64? Mm-hmm. What would you play against somebody else?
If you want, like I said, I'm going to put all the links, the video to where I got this information from, to where I learned a lot about this. And I mean, I've seen this before, but I wanted to get, much
accumulated.
A bit more. I'll put a link to it, but there was some games for it. And a lot of it wasn't that great. I think one of the games was something the giant. Goin' the giant? I can't remember. I'll have to,
Please tell me GoldenEye was one of them. That would have been amazing.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, that would be impossible, yeah.
I could do a whole episode on that alone.
We could do a whole episode on GoldenEye.
GoldenEye alone. Just for, the development cycle. But anyway, that's not part of this episode.
Odd Job was broken.
Yeah, so RANNet was the online service. RANNet didn't start out until go up until 1999. So the Dreamcast had already started going online then. Yeah. The PS2 was close, and the service only lasted 2 years. But due to actually was really successful in Japan apparently, but just due to poor sales of it, it was the people who bought the 64DD loved RANNet. But not a lot of people bought the 64DD, so it's very much, it was a cult fan.
It's a video game version of Firefly.
Yes. Yeah. And so what ended up happening was Nintendo, surprisingly, when the service was going under, they gave people, the last couple months of their thing for free. And gave them a couple extra games that would, granted, they weren't going to last much longer, but it was there. And it's just crazy. And, it's crazy to think that the N64 could go online. No, it's even crazier to think.
What's even crazier, Josh?
The Sega Genesis could go online.
Is that really true?
That's dead. I'm dead serious.
Streets of Rage online.
I don't know. I mean, I'm going to talk about a little bit about the 32X and the CD, because that was the gimmicky. That was the most popular in America. But
that was when it was trying to compete with stuff that was really kind of out of
its league. Well, it was trying to expand the lifespan of the Genesis.
Yeah.
So there was actually two online services, one in Japan, one in America. The one in Japan was called the Mega Modem. This device allowed the users to check the news, weather, banking data, and the ability to use an a printer, an optional printer. Like, you could hook up a printer to the Genesis.
Oh, shit.
In Japan, there was nearly 16 games that had use for the Mega Modem for online play, but it was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have a list of those 16 games, but that's pretty crazy. It was planned to be released in America under the name the Telegenesis Modem, but this was canceled without an announcement.
Yeah.
A lot of the games that came out with it, like, with the American version, it was called the Sega Network, the Sega Channel. You needed the Sega Network cartridge to connect to the Sega Channel. It was, gave access to, like, the Sega Network cartridge gave access to the Sega Games Library, which had a subscription service, which was the Sega Network Channel. Sure. It allows users to download and play games from a menu. Nearly half a dozen of these titles, were available at launch with more promised in the future, but due to lackluster sales, the network was taken offline a year later. Mm. Now, I am reading this kind of verbatim from the video, but this is more just so that way I can express it clearly and not fumble over my words. Mm-hmm. So, giving credit to Did You Know Gaming, I don't mean to plagiarize or anything like
I'm sure they'll be fine.
Yeah, like, I'm not making money off this podcast, so they don't have to worry about it. Yeah, so the Sega Channel was cool. It was for $12.95 a month. You could connect to online, and some of the biggest, like some of the like most infamous games. Or, I shouldn't say infamous. I'm sorry. Sought after games were on this. There was a Mega Man game for the Genesis that was only distributed digitally through this service.
What was it called?
Mega Man: The Wily Wars.
Oh, okay.
Now you can get like ROM hacks like that people like flashed onto Genesis cartridges, so you can play on your Genesis. One of the other games for it was, Game Freak's Pulse Man, which was I have not personally played either of the two, but they were very popular titles.
Yeah.
Sure,
I've heard of Pulse Man before. Not sure.
I mean, since it was a digital DLC thing, it was a little hard to.
Yeah.
I think that's fascinating, personally, like mm-hmm. that. Technology that old could go online.
Yeah, I mean, that's really impressive. I mean, Nintendo was so great.
Well, this Sega is
Genesis.
Sega. But...
Yeah, and I mean, Sega Genesis, it really kind of blows me up. This is, like, honestly my first time hearing of it. I wouldn't have believed it
Super beforehand. Nintendo has a competitor for it, too. Well, actually, no. The Genesis Online service, like, the Sega Channel or whatever mm-hmm. had that was its it made that to compete with Super Nintendo's or Nintendo's right. Which we'll go over in a little bit.
Yeah,
but what were you were gonna finish?
I mean, it was just just the idea that like I can't imagine that internet capabilities were anywhere close to what you would want at like you said $12.95 a month for something like that. That's so. Pointless. Like, it just wouldn't. I just don't see how it would have worked. But at the same time, I guess you gotta give it a try.
I mean, they were getting free games out of it. It's not like now where we pay for like an online I guess most like online game services get games like if it's like Gamefly or like stuff like that. But obviously the infrastructure now for the internet is a lot sturdier than it was back in the early 90s.
Yeah, it's night and day. Early 90s like internet capabilities. Like you're just like. This is before PayPal, isn't it? This is before, I guess, eBay had already, like, started to a certain degree.
I guess just to, like, there, I mean, some of the other stuff I had on the Sega Genesis, I mean, you had the 32X, which was basically them trying to turn the Genesis into a 32-bit console. And they daisy-chained these things together like no other.
It was a straightly bad idea.
It was a really bad idea because, one of the biggest... And the Nintendo's run into this problem, too, with the Wii and the Wii U. It confused the marketplace.
Yeah.
Because you think the Wii and the Wii U are two... Or, the Wii U is an add-on to the Wii, but it's not. They're two separate consoles.
Yeah.
However, you have Sega Genesis and Sega 32X. That sounds like two different consoles, but they're not. They're add-ons to the Genesis.
Reverse,
Same thing with the Sega CD. It's an add-on to the Genesis. Mm-hmm. And all of this was done just to promote the life cycle. Because, the Sega CD was a direct result of the multimedia boom in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. That's why you have consoles like the CDI. That's why you have consoles like... I'm blanking on the other one. I can't think of the other weird, like... multimedia-based console. CDI was the big one that was made by Philips. I can't think of the
name. Oh, well.
It was made by Trip Hawkins, who the same guy I think you started... Yay! 3DO.
That's
it. 3DO. I got it. But multimedia was huge back in the early 90s. That was like where everyone thought it was going. I mean, it kind of went there. But the multimedia is, you know, it's just like the idea that this thing can play music. It can play movies. It can do all these amazing... Play games. Sure. It can do all these amazing things. It's a multimedia device.
Right.
Now, granted, that's what new consoles do now, but they do it much better because they don't rely on the quality of the discs,
yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, multimedia... Like, their big thing was that we have full motion video. Like, if you play PlayStation... Oh, sorry, not PlayStation, Sega CD games, they do have full motion video. They're horrible, but they have full
motion
video.
Some of them are
video.
Really good, though.
Some
isn't,
of them
isn't
are.
The one that has, like, James Earl Jones as like, a character, and it has Mark Hamill playing a particular character as well?
I don't know. I
might be making that up, but, like, it truly looked like a straight-up movie, and it looked incredible for its time. And, yeah, it was really impressive.
Like, one game for the Sega CD that used it well, I would argue, is Snap... Well, I guess well is relatively... is a game called Snatcher. It was made by Hideo Kojima.
Ooh.
Yes. And it was, like, pre-Metal Gear Solid fame. It's because, you know, Metal Gear Solid was 97, I believe.
I think this came out
in the early 93.
Okay.
Well, he had a game... And it's an interesting one, because, like... Kojima's known for, like, loving cinematic-style games. Like,
oh, sure.
All of his games are, like, big, and, like, he wants to make it feel like a movie, but it's in a video game.
Especially happens in the later Metal Gear Solid movies.
Yes. And with Snatcher, it was, like, it was an anime, like, essentially, like, an interactive anime movie. And his sequel to that, his, like, unofficial sequel to that was a game called Police Knots, which was only released in Japan
for the
PlayStation and Sega Saturn. And you can buy, like, fan translations of it, but you... or you can get fan translations of it, but it's, like, you have to, like, get the fan translation, flash it to a PlayStation 1 memory card, and then get the Japanese disc and make sure that your PlayStation isn't region-locked, and, like,
it's a hassle.
I would love to find just a ROM of it, which I'm sure I could. If I search the internet, maybe. I'm sure I could find a fan-translated, like, emulator, but I'd rather, like... I would love to play it, like, on its original thing to support it, but it's, you know... I mean, well, I guess they're not really making money off of that anymore.
No.
But
it's the only thing that's keeping the company afloat.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Sega CD was, like, that was its response to all that. Like, it allowed games like Snatcher, and, I mean, Police Johnson didn't come to it, but it would have been up the alley, up its alley, because it supported full motion video.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, the 32X, and they daisy-chained these things all together with the power supplies and the power cord, so it was impossible
to
do
anything.
It was massive,
yeah.
It was, like, they were bricks, so to plug it in, with a power strip with six plugs in it, you could only fit those three in because it would plug up, it would cover up the other three plugs, because they were so massive.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure they also had advertisements specifically slamming the other, like, essentially its competition.
Well, yeah, Genesis does what Nintendo don't, like, that big advertising campaign.
It was so... Like, the second that you start the conversation off like that, like, you don't, like, these things are shit and you should go with us, immediately you have people just thinking, oh, really? And, like, really challenging? So you really better have a good product or else we're going to find any little hole, just in terms of confirmation bias, we're going to find some sort of a hole to pick out your shit. It's terrible. So it's immediately dismissed, like, wholeheartedly. How long did it last? I'm not
Sega
sure.
Sega CD lasted, and 32X lasted a decent amount. I mean,
oh, yeah?
It's got its fair share of games. Like, a decent amount of games that are actually, like, fairly popular on it, but, I didn't have much else to talk about with Sega. I mean, we covered, like, its online capabilities, we covered the 32X and the Sega CD,
I would argue that most of the stuff in the early ages has to do with online capabilities.
It really does.
Because that's really the frontier. That's really, you know, it was very obvious, especially by, like, the mid-90s, that the internet is going to be the most important invention, the most important tool of our generation. In fact, it arguably, like, has taken us into a completely different age. So it's not surprising that that's what it's all geared towards.
And, well, it's crazy. So, like, on the Super Nintendo, because the Super Nintendo had this thing called the Super Famicom Satellaview. Now, this was only... Or Satellaview. It was only released in Japan. This never came to America. But Sega still had its, like, you know, that was... It created its own version to compete with that. But the Famicom Satellaview, it was a digital it was able to digitally distribute games and other things through satellite. It featured an exclusive downloadable games like F-Zero 2 and a remake of the original Zelda game, but with Link to the Past graphics.
Uh-huh.
These downloads were, you could download these games on expansion cartridges. Like, essentially, you just buy blank Super Nintendo cartridges and just download them onto it. And allowed users to listen to real-time radio shows and read digital magazines. And all of this was accessed in kind of like a hub world. All of it was accessed in like one hub world. It was like a small town.
Yeah.
And you'd walk to the different... The hub world was almost like a small game, like in an RPG. Like, you would just walk to...
Yeah.
Did
they advertise it as such?
I didn't see any ads on...
Yeah, like, I feel like they would.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, the way they describe it in the Did You Know Gaming video is that it's a very Earthbound-like feel.
Ooh. That doesn't sound bad at all.
No.
I
still need to play Earthbound, actually. Yeah. But I would love to play it on its original hardware.
I'm not entirely sure if it would live up to the expectations.
I mean, my roommates played it about a year ago, and they loved it, and it was the first time they played it.
It's a great game, but, like, you know, just don't expect it to be some sort of, like, mind-blowing experience nowadays.
And the only other couple other things I wanted to talk about with the Super Nintendo, one was the Super FX chip. That was more on the game side. The Super FX chip was essentially like a chip they implanted into certain video games to increase its capability. The original Star Fox was a Super FX chip game.
Is that right?
Star Fox was 3D on a Super Nintendo. And so they advert, like, you don't really see it too often with consoles now, like, ooh, look at, like, yeah, now they have, like, console manufacturers advertise their specs, like, look how powerful our system is. But you don't really see them advertising, like, spec add-ons. Like, I didn't cover this with the N64, but there was a RAM add-on. Like, there was a RAM slot you could put 4 extra megs of megs. Ooh.
4 megabytes?
Of RAM.
I'm so happy I was sitting down when I heard
that. It was definitely not gigs. It was megs.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about it. I'm like, was it? No, there's no way they had 4 gigs of RAM in 1996 or 8 or whatever. So they had the Super FX chip, and the Super FX chip just allowed games to have better graphics. Star Fox is a prime example. I think I forget what it is. There's a stunt bike game that used the FX chip. I can't remember the name off of it.
Excitebike.
The last thing I wanted to talk about with the Super Nintendo, and for those who follow a lot of video game history, this might be common knowledge, but for those who don't, I'll explain this briefly for those who do, and for those who don't, maybe you'll find this interesting. The Nintendo PlayStation, because, for those who don't know, Nintendo created their own worst enemy. Back in the early 90s, Nintendo was working with Sony to create a CD add-on, a disk drive add-on to the Super Nintendo. They were making it to, you know, basically expand the capabilities of the Super Nintendo, kind of very similar to how Genesis or Sega was doing it with the Genesis, but I feel like Nintendo was doing it a little bit more tactfully. Like, mm-hmm. Genesis was like, or Sony, Sega was just like, let's throw as much as we can at this.
Yeah.
While Nintendo was like, let's see what we can do with just this disk drive. Well, what ended up happening was I think it was 91 they announced this, like shortly after the Super Nintendo was out. I keep getting all my S's mixed up. Sony revealed the Super Nintendo PlayStation.
Okay.
The very next day, Nintendo says, we're not doing that, we're partnering with Philips.
Oh.
And the reason for it was they realized in the contracts that Sony would make all the money off the disk drive games and Nintendo would make all the money off the cartridge games. While that seems like a 50-50 split, if everything's
going towards
the disc, then they're liable to lose
discs
a lot of
can
money.
Hold more.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the way it's
so made. Sony was so pissed. It's amazing they didn't even just quit the market there, but they were so mad about this that they're like, you know, F it. Let's just go, we'll do it ourselves. So they took the failed project with Nintendo and they made the PlayStation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we get the PlayStation from. So it's kind of funny how Nintendo did that. But
if not for them, then it would have happened otherwise.
Well, it's just funny because then Nintendo really screwed themselves over. They created their own worst enemy, and the partnership they did create with Philips resulted in the CDI, which is universally one of the worst consoles in the world.
Yeah.
So if you want to look more into that, you can Google it. I don't want to bore the people who already know it, but to me, that still fascinates me that, like, that happened. Like, Nintendo created the PlayStation.
Yeah, I'm sure that you can come up with, like, a lot of examples in terms of, like, you know, a lot of people find it, and it's kind of like what we're doing here as well, where it's very easy to criticize what happened in the past when we can, like, see technically into the future, which is now our present.
Well, I'm not criticizing them. No, I understand their move, but...
Yeah, it's just a matter of, like, it's very difficult to, like, see where things are really going to go. Blockbuster had the ability to buy Netflix, but they just decided, well, it's just pointless. We're not going to do that. And Netflix has completely destroyed Blockbuster. And there's a handful of other situations where the same thing has happened. You know, especially with technology, it's very difficult to, like, see what the future is going to bring.
And it's kind of funny because, and think of Blockbuster now, I was going to touch on this more on the NES, but we're pretty much walking our way into the NES section. Only stuff I was going to really cover with Game Boy was like the Game Boy printer and camera, and the link cable. Those were the three big things on the Game Boy.
God, so much printing. Remember when printers were like super important?
It's crazy. But what's funny is with Nintendo versus Blockbuster, there's like, you can look up like tons of research about the lawsuits that Nintendo had against Blockbuster, because Nintendo sued Blockbuster once because Blockbuster was photocopying all the manuals, so that way we wouldn't have to buy multiple manuals. Yeah. Don't remember who won it, but it's been a while since I researched it. But that, like, they sued them for that. Because Nintendo just did not like so they're trying to find any way to sue Blockbuster because they didn't like Blockbuster renting games. So they would buy one game, and Nintendo's not seeing any of that money from the rentals. Oh, it's all Blockbuster. So what Nintendo did was they forced games to be absurdly hard in the American market. Games notoriously known for this, The Adventures of Bayou Billy on the Nintendo, on the NES. I would even argue, like, Castlevania to a degree.
Maybe, yeah.
Because they took out the save states.
Well, there you go.
The Famicom, the Nintendo, or the Famicom, as it's known in Japan, the original one, had a disc system that allowed saving. And so when they ported it over, they didn't do that.
Right.
But I would say probably the most famous one off the top of my head is The Adventures of Bayou Billy. The game is relentlessly difficult and is much easier in the Japanese version because there wasn't as big of a rental market. So the idea was, like, make the games hard so that way the players can't beat it in a week. They have to actually buy the game in order to, like, you know, bash their head into it 1,000 times to beat it.
And this isn't much different than, like, kind of what's going on now. I mean, it would seem that game developers and game companies have always hated the used game kind of market. I've seen plenty of game developers constantly blaming the concept of used games as the reason why gaming companies are failing. And it's honestly absurd. We had this conversation just, you know, not too long ago.
I would love to do a whole episode just on this, like, the comparisons of, like, the film industry to the video game industry, how, like, game budgets are out of proportion.
They're completely ridiculous.
Like, and we said it before, like, it's absurd that Bioshock Infinite, a commercially, critically, and financially successful game overall, because, I mean, well, commercial, that would make, same thing, but it was commercially and critically successful, it still bankrupted the game development studio who made it because it was so expensive to make.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Where a game sells well, where it's a game that you expected it to sell this well, and it still didn't make you your money back. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's just...
It's unreasonable. It's unreasonable to... When you put the expectations so unreasonably high, you can't just then go creating scapegoats out of, like, a used game market. Well, that's been around
and
since forever.
And it's garbage because look at Call of Duty. It outsells itself almost every year.
Yeah.
You know what I see the most of? Call of Duty games. No one buys the used Call of Duty games because no one cares. They always want it's essentially like the iPhone. No one wants the last one. They just want the newest one. It's the same thing with Call of Duty.
When I bought the latest PlayStation, it was literally impossible to buy it without getting a copy of Call of Duty.
Really?
Yeah. I went to Best Buy. I went to GameStop. I went to all those places. I guess I could have gone on Amazon and gotten, like, specifically the console, but in terms of going to, like, a gaming store for the gaming console, they all came with a prepackaged Call of Duty.
That's just crazy.
So, like, my friends are like, well, you don't play Call of Duty, so you could just sell it. I'm just like, everybody has it. If I have it, everybody has it. That's the reason why, like, it'll never work.
I mean, I'd take it from you, but I don't...
If you want it, you can have it.
Because I'm always collecting. Call of Duty is one of those games I will seldomly buy unless it's, like, you know, $10, and it's like the fourth
Yeah, remind
one.
Me after we do the show, and you know, I'll give it to you.
So to move on, I mean, I know we kind of got off topic from the Super Nintendo, but going on down to the NES, I touched on a little bit of this with like the Famicom disk system. The Famicom disk system, I can't speak, was essentially, it was essentially floppy disks mm-hmm. that you could just go in and it was, they were rewritable. So you could save games. Like the original Zelda game was on a Famicom disk system. When they ported it over to the US, they had to add the battery pack in order to save it. I mean, granted, that's an amazing, like, that in and of itself is fantastic because that was the first save, that was the first game you could save your progress on ever on a console, the original Legend of Zelda. So they, like, that wasn't on a disc system, that didn't have rewritable discs. But what's crazy is you could take those discs and you could go to other stores and you could actually, like, go into a store and they'll buy a game from them and they'll just write the game onto the disc. So you would never actually, like, they would have essentially digital copies of discs. Yeah. You would buy the game from the store and you would just write it on there. So a lot of the games that came out for the on the Famicom disc system are just lost because there was no direct
copy.
There was no real copy. It came from a store that you just wrote it on there. So there's a lot of probably unmarked Famicom disc system discs that have games that we've probably never even heard of or seen.
Oh, man.
It's crazy to think
like
about, right?
Lost treasures out into the world.
It was the same thing with, like, the PC game market in the 80s and 90s. There's going to be... There's a lot of games that you'll never know about.
Yeah.
So I talk about the Famicom disk system. The Famicom modem. This was the NES's way to get online, but what they realized was that it wasn't really... They were going to try to do online gameplay, like you see now.
Yeah.
Problem is... Now, this is back in the 80s, like 83, 85.
Yeah.
The infrastructure wasn't there. But what they did end up using it for was you could check banking statistics. Banking statistics. You could trade stocks. You could gamble on horse races. They marketed it towards
adults. That wouldn't even be legal now, would it?
I don't know. Maybe it wasn't Japan, because this is Japan
only.
Oh,
okay.
But they would do that in order to, like, I mean, think about it. They made this gimmick, quote unquote, to market it towards adults. So that way, not only do the kids have a reason to have it, now the adults can use it. Like when the kids aren't. As cheesy as it may sound,
it's terrible, but I guess you can make an argument for it.
Yeah. And then even things like, I mean, I'm not going to touch much on that because, like, we've talked about a ton of online things. It still baffles me that the NES, the Super Nintendo, the Genesis and the N64 could all go online.
Yeah. That's really probably the most important thing that I've taken out of this podcast. It's like, is just how very quickly gaming companies were able to see that the internet is the future.
Even before there was an internet, really.
Yeah.
Which is, it just blows my mind.
I mean, technically speaking, the internet was kind of created during the Cold War.
Yeah.
For things like teleconference, telepresence, that kind of thing. So, to go from, you know, a governmental, military-type thing to a consumer-type thing, I guess it's not particularly that rare. That tends to be how inventions just kind of go. They come out of war, and then eventually they go to peacetime, quote-unquote.
Well, another... where did I hear this from? Bluetooth.
Yeah.
Bluetooth was invented decades ago.
Yeah.
But the military bought the patent, and when the patent finally ran out, just like 10, 15 years ago, or however long it goes, that's when it became a consumer-grade electronic thing. So that is crazy to me that Bluetooth was invented back in like the 70s or 60s or something like that, and then it wasn't until recently that the military, you know, they don't own the patent on it anymore. Now companies can actually, you know, buy it. That's why we have Bluetooth devices.
It's amazing what humanity has been able to figure out, like, how to do when they think that everybody's out to get them.
And I just think it's what I think is the most interesting, especially about video game technology to me, is that you look at, like, consoles like the NES, and you look at, like, hell, I mean, I didn't do any research on this. I'm pretty much stopping at the NES with this one. But the Atari even had, like, some stuff. And it wasn't, like, Atari didn't make this, but there was a third party, I'm blanking on the name of this, but there was actually a way to play Atari games, like, download Atari games to your Atari through phone lines. It wasn't very good, of course, but it existed. I'm blanking on the name of this, but I know I saw it somewhere.
Yeah.
So don't quote me on it, but I'm 90% sure something is out there.
I have quite a handful of pirated Atari games. Did I tell you about that?
No.
Yeah, so you know how an Atari game is just a very classic cartridge.
Yeah.
So what we have is a naked motherboard That you can, like, slide into, like, where it needs to be. And then we would have microchips with, like, you know, Stampede or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And you put it in, and then you'd have to, like, fiddle with, like, a handful of, like, paddles and, like, figure it out. And there you go. You know, you've got a game.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I'm not sure how my father got the games initially, but he's been a computer programmer for, like, as long as both of us have been alive in mind. So, you know, he's able to, like, figure out that kind of stuff.
It astounds me that they have the ability to do this. Like, the fact that, like, game technology was so advanced even back then that they could do this. Like, I think that's why I got into video games so much in the first place. Like, I love games, but what I find more fascinating is the history. Like, the weird things that either game developers and console manufacturers do to, like, try to forward the medium.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I wanted to do this episode, because I love, like, this type of thing fascinates me. Like, I love learning about the weird, I guess you could even say this is more of a peripheral-based episode, but, like, these are gimmicks. Like, not saying that's bad, like, because there's still a couple more that I have to talk about that, like, if the last gimmick I'm going to talk about, if it wasn't for that existing, we wouldn't have the Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it's interesting to me that all these things are this. Like, this is all the things that they try to get the console to be a success.
Yeah.
And the fact that they were so forward-thinking as to think of online stuff back in, like, 1985 and earlier just blows my mind.
Gaming history, I think, is very important for our generation specifically because of how important it is, because of how new it is. It's not necessarily that daunting to do research all the way back to when it first started, because it didn't really start all that early.
I mean, the 60s is, like, the earliest recorded stuff. Yeah, that's basically about it.
And so, you know, it's not particularly daunting. You can do a lot of research on it. There's so much history with it because it went from basically nothing to one of the biggest industries that you have in the world today.
I mean, it makes more than film and music and everything combined.
Yeah, so, you know, you have something that has gone from non-existence to one of the most important things in our culture today.
And on top of that, it like, I believe the Kinect did this too, but, like, the technological advances that we've seen through video games has forwarded, like, technology outside of the video game world.
Yeah.
Like, there's technology that was made by video game, like, console manufacturers that have helped progress computers further and further.
Yeah.
And it's also helped to spur creativity. Like, how many content creators are on YouTube because they are, whether it's because they're reviewing games or whether it's game inspired, or, like, a lot of people's, like, favorite, like, movies and, like literature, whether it's, like documentaries or, by literature, I mean, like, books, you know, like, nonfiction books, or even, like, look at movies and comics like Scott Pilgrim that's heavily video game influenced.
Yeah.
That's part of the reason why a lot of people like it. But it just, like, the creativity shown by these people to make these gimmicks, I know it's kind of it's a lame term to call them, because that's not really what they are, but it's just a generic term to call them.
Yeah.
But the creativity that was used to create these, just, it's astounding. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of, like, go, I only have a couple more things to really comment on. The Power Glove.
It's probably the most famous out of everything.
Yeah.
What was that one thing called? The thing that you would, like, put on your head and it would, like, cover your eye with, like a red scope?
Oh, it was...
like, the Top Gun type of games?
I'm blanking on this. Like,
you know what I'm talking about.
The AVGN did a whole video on, like, NES accessories.
Fire!
I can't remember what it's called. But, yeah, no. And those things were definitely, like, I was trying to keep to a lot of the more of the well-known ones, which is, I mean, I wanted to highlight on the video, the online stuff, because that blows my mind, but, like, I also want to stick to the more well-known ones. If I went to the obscure ones, we'd be here all day.
Uh-huh.
There's a sewing machine accessory for the Game Boy. Do we need to know about that? Not really, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
But you don't really need to know about that. Same thing with a lot of, like, the weird peripherals for the NES.
There's so many of them.
Yeah. But the ones that really tried to sell it, quote-unquote, the gimmicks, Power Glove is probably the biggest one. Not the most important, I would argue, but one of the biggest ones. I mean, you know, it was advertised practically in the advertised in the Wizard.
It was, like, one of the main, like,
It didn't work too well, but it's the groundwork, like you said. Enough people bought it, so motion controls are viable now.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for that. Now, the one I really wanted to talk about was Rob the Robot.
Oh, okay.
So, for those who don't know, this, I think this is a really cool bit of information. Rob the Robot, when Nintendo was coming into the marketplace, the American marketplace, video games were dead. The video game market crashed in 1983 because Atari had no quality control, and all the games were shit. Not all of them, but, I mean, infamously, E.T. spawned the whole thing, or sparked the whole crash.
Before the NES essentially saved console gaming, just, all in all.
And so what happened was, for 2 or 3 years, and I'm glad, I mean, a lot of people say if it had been shorter, this wouldn't have worked. So 2 years was like the perfect amount of time to wait, whether it was on purpose or accident, it was the perfect amount of time to wait. So when Nintendo brought over their console, it wasn't like they decided to test market it in the New York marketplace, a very large marketplace to test it. It wasn't a small one like most people would try. They tried a large one. And to market it, when they initially tried to market it to other, like sell it to other retailers, which wanted nothing to do with the video games, they called it a video game console and no one wanted it. But so what they did to combat this, they're like, no, we're not a video game system. Were an entertainment system.
Hey.
So what they did was they changed the console games to, instead of being like loaded on the top like Atari did.
Yeah.
That's why the original NES is a front. Slide it in the front, and it's like a VCR to kind of like have that, like
make it more relatable to something that people already have in their homes.
Exactly. Yeah. And then they would also package the Zapper in it, which is the gun, which that in itself is a gimmick, successful gimmick.
For sure. It's an arcade's all over the place.
It's a classic. Yeah. Duck Hunt. It wouldn't be fun without it. And there's lots of games that promoted it. Hogan's Alley, Gumshoe. There's a lot of great ones.
Yeah.
I didn't talk much about that because a lot of people know about that. It's an interesting little bit.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to go through all of them.
Yeah, no. But so they packaged with the Zapper, and they also packaged with Rob the Robot. And the reason I say he's one of the most important, he's not good. I'm going to say this. It wasn't a good gimmick, but it's an important one because the fact that they packaged with it was like, look, no, we're not a video game console. Look, we're an entertainment system. You have a robot to play with. You have a gun to play with. And it also, these things interact with these, what are they? They didn't call them games. They called them like, I forget, like controlled packs. It was game packs, not cartridges. They were packs.
Yeah.
So they interact with these packs.
Yeah, it's really more of like an advertisement type.
And
of,
as silly as it sounds, it worked though.
Yeah.
That
doesn't surprise me at all.
It's like, no, we're not a video game system. Look, we have a robot.
We're selling an experience. We're not selling a game.
Exactly. It's essentially how they marketed it.
Yeah.
And it took off. And that's why, for the longest amount of time, people like. You don't call, like, the video games weren't called video games when the NES came out. They were just called Nintendo.
Yeah.
That's how synonymous Nintendo is with video games. And they will always be that way because of what they did to the market in 1985 and reignite the whole
thing. Yeah, they are the market. They're the, you know.
I mean, Sega came out with the Sega Master System, which I didn't talk much about because there wasn't, like, I didn't get to do a lot of research on that one. Uh-huh. And like we said before, there's no way we could talk about all of it. But yeah, so. That's all I had for the Sega the consoles of it. So that's about it for tonight. I want to thank Jay for hanging out with me and talking about this.
Thank you for having me, Josh.
Thank you for coming. I would love to have you back on more.
By all means.
So I hope you guys found this interesting. I know the format I had last time was me splicing up game audio, like of me and Pete playing a game in with. Us talking about it. That will come back. I really enjoyed doing that, and I got some good feedback from some friends on it. So if you like what you hear, give us a review on iTunes. If you want to follow me, I'm at StillLoadingPod on Twitter, and you can also find me on Facebook. I think it's also at StillLoadingPod. Either way, I'll have a link on the Twitter page for it. But rate it, subscribe, let me know what you think. I would love just any kind of feedback, whether it's criticism or otherwise, which, I mean, the internet is born to criticize.
Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like.
Which I'm sure everyone will. But in all honesty, I would like that just to see if what I can do to make this better, because I'm always trying to, like, improve on this.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
See you next time, guys. Jump up, 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 jump up the digital.